let me in. Shiba, shiba. I want to be closer to you. Shiba, shiba. Open up your soul. Shiba, shiba. Let me find that part of you, the part that nobody ever knew.
Let me touch your
mind. Oh, let why don't you let me in? Let me be the first to ever touch your mind.
Hello and welcome to Let Me Touch Your Mind, the show we try to get you to be something, do something, experience something, enjoy something, or if it's the first Monday of the month, understand something on this beautiful, lovely Groundhog's Day. The groundhog can see his shadow, but maybe some people can't see their shadow. We're going to talk about that in just a little bit. I'd like to welcome from the Wonderfest crew. They've sent our latest science envoy. I'd like to welcome Lawrence Mann. Hello.
Hello.
So how are you today?
I'm doing good. How are you, Marilyn?
I'm doing great. So before we get into the science that you do, when did you discover that you had an interest in science?
Yeah. So growing up, I always appreciated the sciences, just studying how the natural world functions. But it all really ties back to when I was 11. When I was 11, I started wearing these specialty contact lenses called ortho-K lenses.
Okay.
And so I grew up needing glasses, but I didn't like wearing glasses, so I wanted to switch over to wearing contacts.
Uh-huh.
These special contact lenses you wear overnight, and what it does is that it actually flattens the front part of your eyeball, the cornea. And by flattening the cornea, you're reducing its refractive power, and then in the morning I take off these lenses, and then I can see again.
I've never heard of these. I'm accustomed to those ones that you just
put on.
Well, I've seen people. I've never worn glasses, so I've seen people put them on. So when did these come about?
These, I would say that they're not quite well known.
Okay.
But I think back in the 90s, people started experimenting with these types of lenses.
Interesting. And what does it correct? Is it for astigmatism?
For nearsightedness.
Oh, okay.
So I was... for those who may know, prescriptions and you know, for glasses, I was about a -3, -4 when I was 11, and so
is that what? How bad is that?
That's not the worst.
Oh, okay.
I could probably right now I'm sitting about 4 feet away from you. I'd probably still be able to see your face.
Oh,
maybe not much.
Oh, okay.
But what these lenses do is they flatten the cornea.
Uh-huh.
And they essentially correct your vision. And then in the morning, I take them off. I can see clearly.
Wow. So your parents were like, we'll make sure that you can wear these things that you wear overnight. And did they do that because they were worried that as a kid, you wouldn't be able to manage them during the day? Or was it just what the doctor recommended?
See, the doctor, the optometrist, recommended these ortho-K lenses because not only can you see clearly when you take off these lenses during the day, you don't need to wear anything, but it also slows down the progression of nearsightedness.
Oh, that's crazy.
Yeah.
And so what was the transition like when you went from from not wearing glasses to having to put them in? And did you know you had it? When did you figure out that you have a vision problem? Because most, like my brother had a vision problem, but no one figured it out till he was 10 years old. They just thought he was goofing off.
Yeah, me too. Like around when I was 9 years old, I just couldn't see the board. And I think because I couldn't see the board in the classroom, I started fiddling with whatever was on my desk.
Okay.
And I mean, I think my parents were pretty responsible.
Sure.
Sent me to the eye doctor every year, and they started noticing that I needed visual correction.
Okay.
And then I went to this optometrist and said, you know, there are these really cool lenses that can correct your vision, and they slow down the progression of myopia.
Oh, wait.
Or nearsightedness, I should say.
All right. So you suggested it to you. I'm confused. Who suggested it to who? Because it sounds like you knew about it.
I didn't know about it.
Okay.
So the optometrist was the one who told me and my parents, hey, look, these ortho-K contact lenses exist. They're a thing. And they also slow down the progression of nearsightedness.
And so then that got you interested in vision as a general rule?
Yeah.
Or?
So, It all actually started out not so sciencey, but I wanted to pursue the career of an optometrist because as I was growing up, I constantly broke my lenses. I was growing, so I needed new lenses.
Oh, okay.
So I'd always go to the optometry clinic, visit my optometrist, get new lenses. But I also noticed, like, wow, this is a cool profession. I should look into it. And so in undergrad, I majored in cell and molecular biology. I worked part-time at an optometry clinic. So have you ever been to the optometry clinic and, you know, people are shooting puffs of air into your eyes?
Yeah.
I'm the person
who's
operating those instruments. And I was also doing retinal scans, retinal images for patients. And so that was my role as an optometric assistant. So I was really into eyes and into vision. And so I thought, why don't I try doing vision or eye research in the academic setting at my university? And so I reached out to some professors. I actually started researching mechanisms behind nearsightedness, why it occurs. And I also dabbled in studying the gene expression of light-sensitive proteins in tadpoles. That research was what really solidified science for me as a career. And so in the lab, you know, you're doing experiments, but the most exciting part for me was when I was looking under the microscope. I see the answers. I see what's in the retina, in basically these sections of the retina.
Of the tadpole or
it's
of the retina?
It's a tadpole.
Okay,
the tadpole retina.
Okay.
And that's when I realized this. I had a high for the joy of discovery.
I love that.
That's what really solidified it for me. I said, this science, it's going to be my career.
Did you ever tell your optometrist that you wanted to be an optometrist?
I did.
And then you actually did it. So have you seen your optometrist since you went full eye?
I have.
Oh, okay. Is he thrilled?
Oh yeah, he's very supportive. And you know, not everyone has to go into, you know, optometry or the professional world of healthcare.
Yeah.
Because I think people in healthcare still appreciate, you know, people who do the background research. And so he was very supportive.
Well, I love that because, you know, kids want to, you know, they change what they want to do all the time. It's like one week they want to be an optometrist, the next a fireman, then one week a puppy, you know. But you, like, said it, and then I'm sure he was watching like, oh, this kid's really going to do it. And he's doing it.
Yeah.
I love that. So tell me about this tadpole research, because that sounds fascinating.
Yeah, so I was studying these light-sensitive proteins, and more specifically the genes that encode these proteins.
Okay.
These genes are not found in humans.
Oh, okay.
And so in humans, we think about light perception coming from the retina. And the retina is three layers. There's the top layer, which contains the photoreceptors. Those are just cells that detect light. They're the ones that absorb the photons. That's how we're able to see.
Mm-hmm.
And we generally think that what's responsible for these photoreceptors being able to detect light are these proteins that absorb photons. These are called opsin proteins, but I'll just call them light-sensitive proteins. In humans, they're generally just in the photoreceptors, in that first layer.
Okay.
There are exceptions to this rule, but I won't get into it. But in the frog, in the tadpole, I found that there were light-sensitive proteins, not just in layer one, that's normal for a lot of retinas, but it's also in the second and third layers as well. So how the retina works is usually the first layer, that's the one detecting light.
Mm-hmm.
It sends information to layer two, and then the third layer, and then information goes to the brain.
Okay.
But in this tadpole that I was studying, these light-sensitive proteins were in layer two as well as in layer three.
Oh.
And that's really interesting because we could call these neurons intrinsically photosensitive. And that was fascinating because what does that mean for tadpole vision? How do they see? Because normally the ones detecting light are in layer one.
Uh-huh.
But if all three layers are detecting light, then we don't know exactly how tadpoles see. And so to just kind of do the groundwork, I was just asking the question, which retinal neuron types are expressing these genes. And okay. So that was, I was an undergraduate. That project was for a year, and it was really cool. I found different types of these opsins or light sensitive proteins expressing in all different types of retinal cells.
Now, I'll be honest with you, I've never thought of tadpoles as having eyes, because you know, whenever you see them, they're just like sort of translucent, you know, they kind of look like sperm and they're just wiggling around. The eyes must be microscopic.
Oh, very, very small. So how
do you even, if they're that small, then how do you know that there are that many layers?
So what you can do is, well, at least under a microscope, you can see their eyes.
Oh, okay.
You just have to zoom
in.
They
just have two, like every
other? Yeah, they got two eyes.
All right.
And then through the power of microscopy, we're able to just zoom in and look at the tiny structures. And we still see three layers, just like the human.
So then what did you learn about how tadpoles see, or is it still just this big mystery?
It's still a mystery to me because I graduated from my undergrad.
And oh, okay.
I couldn't continue on that research because I moved here to the Bay Area to pursue my PhD. So right now, I still don't know how tadpoles are utilizing these novel genes to see. I have no clue, but you know, that's part of the excitement about science. There's always something to pursue after.
Well, that makes me wonder then, like, the tadpoles, when they morph into frogs and toads, do they still have that many layers?
Yes, they still have the three retinal layers.
Okay.
But I don't know if those genes are still being expressed
into
adulthood.
All right. So you discover, how did you discover that tadpoles have, was that something that was already known before you went in?
Yeah, so it was known that these tadpoles had these, they expressed these genes, but no one knew where in the retina it was exactly expressed or which exact cell type expressed these genes.
Okay.
So that's where I came in. And to analyze where genes are being expressed, so genes, you know, you could think of DNA. DNA is turned into something called mRNA. So it's just, some biological molecular structure. What you can do is you can have a probe that binds to the mRNA.
Okay.
And these probes, you know, they stick to the, you know, your gene expression of interest, and they can fluoresce. And so under the microscope, I can see cells that are fluorescing, meaning those cells are expressing that gene of interest.
Okay. Now, for our listening audience who may not be well-versed in RNA and DNA and other, what does it mean for a gene to express?
Yeah, so for a gene to express, it means it starts off as DNA, and then DNA is converted to something called mRNA.
What's the M for?
Messenger.
Oh, okay.
And then that RNA turns into protein.
Okay.
It's sort of like translating English to French and then to Spanish.
Oh, okay.
Sort of like that.
All right.
These are just different languages, but the end result is a protein.
Okay.
And I guess in my analogy, Spanish is the end result.
All right. So why does it have to go through those phases? Why can't it just express directly?
Yeah, this is a juicy question.
Ooh, yeah.
Because it may involve some ideas surrounding evolutionary biology, where perhaps the first organisms they just used this middle product, the mRNA, or just RNA in general. And then RNA is, maybe you can think of it as more versatile. Maybe you will say that the mRNA is English. In this world, English is a little more versatile. But then DNA came into the scene later because it's more stable.
Okay.
And so through mechanisms of biology and evolution, that's where DNA came into place. And then it is turned into RNA, and then RNA is turned into protein.
So it sounds like you're telling me, and correct me if I'm wrong, that initially organisms were RNA, and then at some point in the evolutionary history, something called DNA came into existence. And did it go RNA, then RNA to mRNA, and then RNA to mRNA to DNA? Or was the mRNA needed because the DNA was separate? How did that, all that work?
Wow. So mRNA was needed because of DNA.
Okay.
I think.
So where'd the DNA come from? Is it just a mutation?
Maybe. I think people are still trying to figure this out.
Oh, okay.
Where it's like, how in the world did the first organism or cellular organism mm-hmm. come to exist?
Yeah.
And then people are still figuring out, like, oh, because RNA is pretty similar to DNA in terms of structure.
Okay.
But then there are some molecules that are a little different. I think people are still figuring out, like, why that happened.
Now, I read a long time ago, and I don't even know if it's true, but it said that when fetuses are developing, like, they go through all of the processes in the same way that the species developed. Does that make sense? Like the organism that's over here and the organism that goes over here, it follows the same pattern to get from one point to the other. Does that make sense to you?
Like how human fetuses look like cats or
like tadpoles or whatever. And then it just keeps, it's almost like they're adding on a new process at the end each time.
Yeah, isn't that remarkable?
That's true, then, is what you're saying.
I don't know if it's true, but I personally don't study evolutionary biology, but it is very crazy, like how you mentioned sperm earlier looks like just mini tadpoles.
Mm-hmm.
And then when, you know, in the fetus stage, we're just like balls or clumps mm-hmm. of cells that morph into something that kind of looks like maybe like a fish or
mm-hmm.
Yeah, so it's remarkable how that happens. I personally don't know why it had to be that way. Like, why didn't we just sprout? Well, developmental biology is a very complicated process, and you want to start off with a structure that's very simple. So maybe we start out as, like, a stick-looking fetus.
Right. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And then, yeah, we'll sprout, you know, the head, the arms, and the legs later on.
Well, I know I've drifted a long way away from eyes. I'm fascinated by eyes. I planned ahead, I would be wearing all my eye jewelry and whatnot. So tell me, so you went from doing the tadpole research, and then what was the next stage in your research development?
So I always wanted to study retinal degeneration.
Okay.
And so that's when those photoreceptors, the cells in layer one that detect light, that's when they die off and people mm-hmm. go blind.
Oh, okay.
So I really wanted to study retinal degeneration because this has a significant impact on the world. You may have heard of age-related macular degeneration.
I have.
This is a pretty big disease that's in the category of retinal degeneration.
Mm-hmm.
And I wanted to study it and then in the future try and cure it, or at least join the fight to cure blindness in this way. So
macular degeneration, because I'm a woman of a certain age and I have listeners of a certain, like, is it a guarantee that it's going to happen, or is it a piece of DNA that expresses its, like,
right.
How, like, what percentage of the population is going to develop macular degeneration or age-related macular degeneration?
I think the odds are around 1 in 100.
Oh, okay.
But there are other factors that play into this as well.
Mm-hmm.
Like, age is a factor.
Mm-hmm.
Your lifestyle is a factor. So if you don't exercise or if you eat junk food all the time, if you smoke, these are all factors that may play a role in, you know, triggering macular degeneration.
Okay. So you say, I want to study macular degeneration, and you go into the lab. So what's the first thing that you discover or that you learn about macular degeneration that just blew your mind?
The first thing that I learned,
mm-hmm.
and I need to also say that I study these retinal degeneration models in mice.
Oh, okay.
Because I am a visual neuroscientist, I do a lot of experimental techniques in mice rather than humans, because a lot of the techniques I use are a little invasive and no human really wants to go through what I do to the mice.
Mm-hmm.
But at least in mice, I learned that when they lose their photoreceptors, cells in the layer 3, they become hyperactive. They start becoming overactive.
Uh-huh.
And remember, these cells in layer 3 are the output cells of the retina. They go and project to the brain directly.
Mm-hmm.
And so this hyperactivity is bad because it can mask leftover signals coming from the surviving or leftover photoreceptors. It's kind of like I'm talking to you right now, but let's say there's, you know, a child in the room that's crying. That noise or that hyperactivity from the child is masking over my voice, and while I'm trying to communicate to you, that noise cannot, you know, I can't communicate to you properly. So that's kind of what those cells in layer 3 are doing.
Okay, so they're running amok. So any vestiges of vision you have are being interfered with by this layer 3. So that interference, can you moderate that?
Yes. So in the lab that I'm in, previously people have discovered what causes this hyperactivity.
Okay.
And then how to get rid of it.
Okay.
And so in short, when the retina is degenerating, there are cells that remodel. You know, and this remodeling is just a fancy term for structural changes to neurons or functional changes to neurons. And we found out that these cells in the third layer are undergoing, you know, they're expressing genes differently or more, which is causing them to be more excitable.
Okay. So what it sounds like what you're saying is your genes were expressing one way when you had vision, and then as your vision deteriorates, your genes start expressing in a different way.
Yes.
Which is wacky to me.
Yes.
It's almost like saying suddenly you went from being a blonde to a redhead.
Yeah, that's why I was really surprised. But people have tried to speculate on why this happens, or like go to the root cause of why this happens. But in my lab, people have found out that retinoic acid, this is a molecule, it's a derivative of vitamin A, actually. There's more retinoic acid in the degenerated retina, and retinoic acid can influence gene expression.
Okay.
And then retinoic acid is what causes this hyperactivity, or some of it, at least.
All right, I have some, okay. You're mentioning a vitamin A. This is off topic, but we all grew up hearing that, oh, if you eat a lot of carrots, it helps your eyesight. And then at some point I heard that, oh, no, that was just something that Americans put out to
hide. Big carrot companies saying them.
All of them. Yeah, I like that, big carrot. But they were saying that, no, it was that they were doing spying on Russia and didn't want Russia to know about its spying capabilities. So they were saying, oh, Americans just see better because they eat more carrots. What exactly is the truth about eating things and improving your eyesight?
Yes. So a lot of people will say, eat your carrots. It'll help you see better.
Carrots and hominy grits.
However, I wouldn't say that's misinformation, but vitamin A is crucial for our vision because in the photoreceptors, vitamin A gets converted to something called retinaldehyde. And retinaldehyde is actually the key molecule used by the light-sensitive proteins to detect light.
Okay.
So this retinaldehyde molecule is incorporated into the light-sensitive proteins.
Okay.
And then when light gets absorbed by this complex, then the protein can respond and say, aha, I detect light.
Okay.
Now I'll send information.
Okay.
In the developed world, like like the United States, most people already have enough vitamin A in their diet to not be affected by this. However, in underdeveloped countries where perhaps people don't have enough vitamin A in their diet,
mm-hmm.
they may not see because they don't have if they don't have vitamin A, they don't get the retinaldehyde, and then they won't be able to see.
Okay, so where do people get vitamin A besides carrots and hominy grits?
I think in general, vegetables have vitamin A.
Oh, like just sort of across the board.
Yeah, but carrots have, you know, they're well known for having more
right.
vitamin A.
Okay, so it wasn't necessarily strictly just propaganda to fool the Russians.
Enzymatic process or
mm-hmm.
reaction.
Mm-hmm.
And then it makes these alcoholics really feel the effects of a hangover.
Mm.
And so if they drink, they get really hungover. And so the drug that they're on just really prevents them from drinking alcohol.
Okay.
Turns out this drug can also be used in the degenerated retina.
How'd they figure that out? Did alcoholics suddenly get better vision, or what was going on?
No. It's just a completely separate process, because in the lab, people already knew that there was enhanced retinoic acid signaling in the degenerated retina.
Yeah.
And then they just realized, oh, that drug over there, disulfiram,
uh-huh.
can block this pathway. Let's test it out.
How did they know that? I don't understand how you make that leap.
Okay. So disulfiram blocks a protein called retinaldehyde dehydrogenase,
okay.
or aldehyde dehydrogenase in
uh-huh,
general.
Uh-huh.
This converts retinol,
oh,
or
okay.
retinaldehyde, sorry, to retinoic acid.
Okay.
Or
now I get it. Okay.
Or and not just the retinol part, but
mm-hmm.
it converts aldehydes to these acid products.
Okay.
And so
that
people,
makes sense.
So, so through that, it's like you can apply that principle to retinaldehyde
mm-hmm.
and retinoic acid.
Mm-hmm. And that's what these trials are showing, that it's having some effect.
I actually don't know the results of the trials
okay.
yet. I think they're still underway.
Okay. So then I'm going to ask you about like a typical day for you in the lab. What does that look like?
Yeah. So what I do is I still study the hyperactivity
mm-hmm.
of these cells in layer 3. And so my typical day is I go find a mouse. I have to, unfortunately, you know, take out its eyes. I dissect out the retina, and I put the retina onto a bunch of electrodes, where these electrodes measure neural activity.
Mm-hmm.
And then I assess the neural activity with my mouse. And I use a special mouse that doesn't have degenerated retinas. I'm actually studying like what triggers the remodeling. I mentioned that word earlier.
Yeah, yeah.
I study what causes neurons in the retina to undergo structural changes and functional changes.
Uh-huh. But how do you figure that out if the eyes, how do you figure out the neural networks if the eyes aren't actually in the mouse?
Sorry?
So if you're removing the eyes from the mouse and then you're trying to learn stuff, but the eyes aren't in the mouse anymore, so how do you...
So I just study it at the cell level. I don't study the behavior or I don't test the vision from mice, at least not for my current experiments that I'm
okay.
talking about. I just care about whether or not the cells in layer 3 are undergoing remodeling from a special mouse that I'm using.
Okay. So you put them on a thing and you look at them, and then what other types of things are you doing while you're in the lab?
I also, my favorite experiment that I've done so far
okay.
was, so glutamate is a neurotransmitter that neurons use.
Okay.
People have found a way to engineer a fluorescent protein where if glutamate binds, it fluoresces.
Okay.
So basically, it's a glutamate detector.
Okay.
I have this glutamate detector in degenerated mice, and I can look at the activity of glutamate signaling, glutamate neurotransmitter signaling in the degenerated retina. So this is another experiment that I do where I'm looking at these waves or patterns of fluorescence because there's glutamate in the retina and then uh-huh. it's gone and then it's there and then it's gone. Or it's not gone, it's like sucked up by cells.
Oh, okay. And so what is the glutamate, what is the purpose of glutamate?
Glutamate is the neurotransmitter, so it's the communication
tool. Okay.
So one cell will release release glutamate and it excites the other cell, telling it to go do your job.
Got it. Now, in your research, was there anything that, and we're talking any of the research, the tadpoles, has there ever been something that surprised you in the course of doing your research?
Every day is like a surprise to
me. Okay.
Although I can try and hypothesize what happens, I feel like oftentimes I can be wrong. And that's part of the fun of being a scientist.
Well, what's something that you're like, oh, I wasn't expecting that? Tell me one of those instances.
Yeah. So this relates back to that glutamate protein that fluoresces.
Mm-hmm.
I did not expect to see oscillatory activity going on in the retina that I was experimenting on.
Okay.
Because I didn't think it would behave so weird. Because in degenerated retina, you do expect to see oscillations of neural activity, let's say.
Okay, yeah.
And I'm using a special mouse model where the photoreceptors are still alive, mm-hmm. but they're taken offline. Like, they don't communicate to layers 2 or 3. And I was surprised to see that there are these oscillations in neural activity. I think that's been something that stumps me.
Mm.
And this is something I recently discovered in the lab about a few months ago. I'm still figuring out, you know, what to make of it. And it still boggles me.
So when you discover this oscillation of activity and you're like, oh, I wasn't expecting that, do you go and talk with the leader of the research team? What happens when something unexpected like that occurs?
I share it with the people in the lab. Yes.
Uh-huh. Does everyone just run and start looking through your microscope?
I wish I could do that. Uh-huh. Like, everyone come into the room. But the room is really small with this microscope. But I show people through, like, videos.
Okay.
And so I show my professor, and, you know, it was like the coolest thing that I've done in my project. And I get a lot of advice from him about what to do next, or, like, mm-hmm. why this is happening.
So what are some of the hypotheses of why this oscillation is occurring?
Well, a hypothesis is that when you take the photoreceptors offline,
mm-hmm.
they're not dead, but they just aren't active anymore. The retinal circuit, it's just like, why is there no more input?
Mm.
Why is there no activity coming from layer 1? And then through weird electrical properties, it kind of just goes berserk.
Okay.
Because it's no longer receiving input. I wonder if I can think of an analogy.
No, what you said just makes sense.
Okay.
So that's but one hypothesis. Are there other hypotheses, or is that the only one?
Another hypothesis is, well, it could be related, but mm-hmm. when the photoreceptors are no longer responding,
mm-hmm.
the downstream neurons are saying, like, why am I not receiving input anymore?
Mm-hmm.
I will now try and change my genes.
Mm.
And then by changing the genes, you can affect the intrinsic excitability or intrinsic electrical properties of neurons, which then lead to oscillations and hyperactivity and a lot of corruption going on in the retinal circuit. So I don't know if it's just the natural response
mm-hmm.
with no changes in gene expression, or if there is gene expression that causes this, like, these berserk things to happen.
Got it. Now, you mentioned that you actually worked in optometrist office and all of this. Have you had any dealings with human eyes since you're working, or is it all mouse eyes all the time?
Yeah, I wish I could work with human eyes, but I haven't had the opportunity to do that.
Okay. So it's just tadpoles and mice.
That's all I've experimentally worked on.
Okay, okay. And this is just like a personal question, is when people know that you do eye, have done eye stuff, do they suddenly pepper you with questions like, my eye's really dry and I don't know what happened?
It happens all the time. When I tell people I study retinal degeneration or mm-hmm. I study vision science, mm-hmm. they ask like, oh, I need to go to the eye doctor to get new glasses. Something very far off from uh-huh. what I do. I don't treat dry eye or...
Right.
But it happens all the time. It's really funny. I love to entertain those questions.
Are you ever able to actually, from your experience in the optometrist's office, actually able to give them some advice?
I can give advice, but, you know, because I'm not a doctor, I say that, like, look...
Yes.
This is maybe what you have, but uh-huh. definitely go see an eye doctor.
And then what do your folks think of, like, do they do the same thing? Like, son, you know, I know you're cutting up mouse eyeballs, but can you tell me what drops to use? Or do they do anything like that?
Oh, yeah. And they also ask me, like, these weird questions about, like, oh, I learned about how you can take this pill and see if it prevents macular degeneration.
And you say...
You probably came across an ad that's trying to scam you.
the age old quest to keep your parents from falling victim to some weird scam.
Yeah.
So, what is your favorite part of working in the lab?
It's the exact same enjoyment that I had in my undergrad degree when I was studying those tadpoles.
Is looking through the microscope?
No, and beyond that, it's just. I actually do look under microscopes a lot, but uh-huh. it's the joy of discovery. When I analyze the results, when I process all my data and mm-hmm. I come up with an answer, that's when all the satisfaction happens. That's when I get some relief or I get, you know, I'm tickled by, like, these results.
So you talk about collecting the data. So is that just a bunch of numbers or what are we talking about? Is it a big old spreadsheet filled with... And what are you tracking? Are you tracking, like, tell me what you're tracking.
Yeah, I track many things.
Okay.
On the microscopy side, uh-huh. I'm tracking fluorescence.
Okay.
So fluorescence can go up, it can go down. And basically, it gets converted into a number.
Sure.
Like an arbitrary number, like
all right.
50 units worth of fluorescence.
Okay.
And all these numbers... go into a big old spreadsheet,
okay.
and then I can, depending on the experiment, like if I'm looking at the decrease of fluorescence over time,
mm-hmm.
I can look at the decrease of fluorescence and find something like a half-life. You know, if you think of radioactive decay, I can, you know, basically process data in that way.
Mm-hmm.
I was talking about oscillations earlier and looking at the levels of glutamate being released in the retina.
Mm-hmm.
So it starts off as images with fluorescence.
Mm-hmm.
So I take the levels of fluorescence, it turns into a number. And then from those numbers, I can see, oh, it's going up and then going down, up and down. And these oscillations can be processed through, you know, computing and programming.
And I'm assuming that when you're measuring these oscillations, you have some really finely tuned meter that's spitting out numbers as opposed to just sort of randomly assigning them on your own.
Well, when I'm doing the experiment, I'm just capturing images.
Uh-huh.
There are no, I mean, the numbers are kind of embedded in the image, like the fluorescence.
Okay.
I haven't quite gone to what you're talking about just having numbers spit out immediately.
No, not necessarily, but I mean, like how you're capturing this fluorescence and... you're not assigning a number. There is some sort of...
Like a software that detects it for me.
Is that... That's correct?
Yes.
Okay. So...
I can't arbitrarily say, this looks like a...
That looks like a four.
Yeah. That would be terrible.
That would not be scientific.
Yeah.
So do you ever have times when something is fluorescing, it's oscillating, and then it just disappears altogether?
I have not seen that behavior. But if it does, something is oscillating and then just flatlines,
uh-huh.
I would suspect that my microscope isn't working anymore.
Okay.
Or my retina somehow died. I have not encountered this behavior before, and I hope
okay.
I don't.
Well, then, like when we think about, I'm thinking of a bell curve. There's the stuff that you regularly experience, but what are the outliers that you have witnessed with your research?
When the microscope does not work.
So you only get deviations if there's something wrong with your equipment, is what you're saying.
Yes.
Oh, okay.
And
well, that's reassuring, actually.
Yeah. And so, there have been times where the equipment is working,
mm-hmm.
but my mouse is not what I think it is. So I mentioned how I have this special mouse.
Right.
The photoreceptors are still alive. They're not degenerated. But they do not communicate to the downstream neurons.
Mm-hmm.
That's what I think. And we're able to validate this stuff in the lab. But then there are times where I don't need to validate it anymore because I'm using the same strain. Like, you know, we breed these mice.
Mm-hmm.
If the grandfather or grandmother, they behave the way we expect them to, then we expect, you know, all the offspring to behave the same way. There have been times where, for some reason, maybe it was due to poor breeding
mm-hmm.
or control of the breeding,
mm-hmm.
I expected my mice to behave a certain way. But it didn't, and I went through a whole month just to troubleshoot, like, why can't I replicate my data from a month ago?
Mm-hmm.
I'm using mm-hmm. the same strain.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I thought it was the same strain. And so those moments suck.
Oh, okay.
These are the outliers. Yeah, most of the time, they suck. There are
okay.
some times when the outliers are really cool,
mm-hmm.
but they don't tend to stay as outliers for long, because if something's cool, I'm going to make that my norm and pursue that.
So in the field of macular degeneration, while you're doing all of this research, have there been any major breakthroughs in macular degeneration research while you've been studying it?
Yeah, you know, the most recent thing that I saw was a paper published in the New England Journal of Medicine.
Uh-huh.
And so right here in the Bay Area, there's a company called Science Corporation.
Okay.
They make these chips that are surgically implanted into people with macular degeneration.
Mm-hmm.
And people can see again, or they can read.
Really?
They can't see as like well as they originally did, but at least they can read things.
Okay.
And so this is a huge advancement in the area of curing blindness. And so this was a huge win for people macular degeneration.
Now, I, as a lay person, when I see these briefs or, you know, whatever you call them, to me it's just a wall of text with no paragraph. I mean, it's just like, but it seems that for scientists, they have no difficulty reading it at all, and it's fascinating and amazing. So do you experience it as, wow, this is a great thing? Or do you experience it more like me, which is like, oh, I wish they left some white space and maybe a picture or two?
I think I'm in between
okay.
this ideal scientist expectation and you. I don't like reading huge, huge walls of text.
Mm-hmm.
But in a lot of papers, they have figures, right?
Mm-hmm.
Like they're essentially pictures. And you kind of have to get good at interpreting some of their graphs. But that's what I mainly look at when
mm-hmm.
I read papers, because the text is essentially just explaining the figures. But if you can just look at the figure and the graphs
mm-hmm.
and just, you know, infer from it, that's all you need. And then if you really want, then yeah, read the wall of text to get even more information.
Okay. So what is something about your brand of research that doesn't come up regularly, like something that you would want the public to know about?
Yeah, this is the phenomenon of retinal remodeling.
Okay.
I think, because kudos to a lot of people out there who are trying to restore vision, whether it's through like the cell replacement therapy
mm-hmm.
or by surgically implanting chips.
Mm-hmm.
But remodeling is overlooked, I would say. I would hope that a lot of people who are studying these ways to bring back vision also incorporate the knowledge of what's going on in the degenerated retina, which is remodeling, where the neurons are not the same as before. When we talked about how these neurons are changing in gene expression,
mm-hmm.
they're changing in their activity, that cannot be overlooked.
Okay.
And so I think that needs to be, you know, given more spotlight.
So are you saying that because the remodeling is being overlooked, it is the research is not as successful because they're not factoring that in?
That's part of it. Or I think there should be a combination of mm-hmm. techniques that address vision restoration uh-huh. and stopping remodeling. And
oh, okay.
that together, I think though that would really improve vision. It's like two therapies in one.
Okay. Now, what lab are you doing your research at?
So at the University of California, Berkeley,
my alma mater.
I am in the Kramer Lab.
Okay, okay. And who is your team lead? Are you the professor that came up with this research?
Richard Kramer is my professor. He's the one who's my boss, my supervisor, the leader of the lab. He's the one that is essentially the one guiding
mm-hmm.
these experiments.
And how much longer will you be able to do this research?
I hope I can do this type of research until the rest of my life.
Oh, okay. You're a lifer.
I would love to stay in this field of neuroscience, visual neuroscience, and trying to solve blindness. But, I need to graduate at a certain point.
We all do, yeah.
I may graduate this year or next year, probably this year.
And you'll have your PhD.
I'll have my PhD, and I hope to go work for, it could be a company in the industry, or mm-hmm. I could go pursue a postdoctoral fellowship. But either way, I hope to stay in visual neuroscience.
Excellent. Well, with that, we have come to the end of our discussion. So is there anything that you want to make sure our listening audience knows about what you do?
I would say just go get your eyes checked. Going to the eye doctor once is not good enough. What they care about is looking at the progression of mm-hmm. your vision,
mm-hmm.
Whether that's checking your eye pressure for glaucoma or just seeing, how good your peripheral vision is. You need to go consistently so that doctors can see a progression to see if things are getting worse or if things are staying the same. I think that's probably the biggest piece of advice I can give to our listeners.
Well, I think that's excellent advice. So, Lawrence Mann, I want to thank you so much for being on the show today.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
Okay, people of Earth, you heard him. You need to go and get your eyes checked. I am probably as guilty as anyone of, kind of avoiding the medical profession and all of that, but you need your eyes to see. You need your eyes. You need your eyes. You need your eyes. And you know what? You also need to go out and have a good time and enjoy this world. And I hope that Lawrence has shed some light on vision and what's going on out there. I'm going to leave you with a series of eye songs. And I will see you next week. It's Groundhog's Day, so maybe watch that movie. Until next week, my friends, ta-ta and toodly-doo.